Hey, good evening, everyone. It's Mojo with Kojo here. It's about 6 p.m. Thursday evening, so January 16th, 2025. I have my friend and brother from another mother, Mr. Paul Martin. He agreed to do one of the first interviews, so we're gonna go ahead and start the interview. And again, this is to show people and veterans that you can do it. You may think you're alone, but you are not alone. There are people out there that are going through pretty much the same thing, that you're going through, and you're definitely not alone. And if you need help, all you have to do is ask. So anyway, let's go ahead and jump into this. So Paul served in the Marines, and he served 23 years total. So served 4 years in the Marines, active duty, 2 years in the Marine Corps Reserve. Then he went to serve in the U.S. Army National Guard, and he just wrapped up serving in the United States Air Force Reserve. So for a total of 23 years. So Paul, the first question that I'd like to ask is, how was your childhood?
I want to say that it was a really good childhood overall. My dad was an airman. He joined the Air Force right out of high school. He was Vietnam era. I was born in 1969, so kind of tells you the time frame and the environment. Blue collar guy raised by a blue collar family. And the way he always described it to me when I was a kid, and then when I myself joined the military is like he knew he was going to get drafted for Vietnam. He wasn't college material. It's not really the direction he wanted to go. And they were drafted people. So he's like, you know what? I'd rather make a choice than be told what to do. So he joined the Air Force. And sure enough, the joke was always that his mom wrote him a letter while he was in basic training for the Air Force to say that his draft letter came in to report to the MEPS, and then they were gonna process him, which if he'd have volunteered, there's a real good chance that, he'd have been like a lot of guys at that time period where he'd be like, hey, you're joining the army, you're going infantry, yay. So he made the right choice for himself. Met my mom, and when he was stationed on Okinawa, and so he was that generation that married a Japanese woman and brought her home to the States. And so it was, I want to say it was a good childhood overall. Like there were some unique struggles to it. In my mind, they're unique compared to a lot of my friends. But if you grew up around a military base, I'm imagining that like my mom and dad's story would have been like one of many.
Like
But we
cookie
grew up in
cutter.
Angola. Yeah, because if you grew up on active duty and he'd have stayed in the military, there'd have been a bunch of other guys that had gone and been stationed at Naha or Kadena or any place like that, and they'd been like, oh yeah, my wife's Okinawan too, and then my mom would have had a community to help her. But so she stayed at home most of the, I she stayed at home all the time actually. There was a period of time when she brought in work. She brought in piecework, basically, like she was getting paid to sew medical gauze. So they brought in this industrial sewing
That's really
machine.
cool.
Yeah, they brought in an industrial sewing machine, and she would have this woman that was coming to the house, and she'd bring a box of stuff that needed to be sewn, and then my mom would give this woman the box of stuff that she had stitched together. And so she was getting paid per piece to do that for a while. Having my mom in the house all the time, good and bad, because like you're a kid and you go nuts and you drive each other crazy and stuff. I mean, there were some ups and downs. By no means was it ideal. It was a little bit closer to, like I don't know if you know the Goldbergs, the TV show about the kid growing up in the 80s, and his mother's a smother. She just drives him crazy because she's always in his business.
It
Or
sounds
the
familiar, but I don't know.
If anybody watching this knows, they'll get it. But the like she was, when your mom's Asian, they call it a tiger mom. Now generically they
Oh,
call it
okay.
being mother. So she was always in our business. But being an adult now and with kids of my own, I'm like, yeah, it was probably better that she was more involved than less involved. But there were struggles because she had no support network. She came to the US She left behind family and friends in Okinawa. And so it was hard for her because the English was her second language. She spoke, but not great. So,
Right.
like, you come to a whole new country and you really have no marketable job skills. You know, you don't have cultural connection, and things like that. So, you know, there were times when it was hard on her, and then that would bleed over into the household. And then there was just the typical marriage stuff here and there. So it was by no means ideal, but I definitely want to say that I was lucky enough to have a good childhood overall.
Right. If you don't mind me asking, how long did your dad serve in the military?
To the best of my knowledge, it was either 4 or 6 years.
I got you.
He never really talked about it. I got some stories out of him, but he wasn't one to tell stories. And I mean, he was a crew chief for a C-130. I know he did a trip to England at one point after he went through all of his training schools and everything and was assigned to a plane and a unit. I know he'd been to England because he used to tell jokes about how he couldn't understand it when they were yelling at him about walking on the lawn because of the way they spoke English versus the way we speak English. And he had some cool stuff when he passed away. I went through and I'm like, oh my God, I wish my dad would have like shown me this stuff so we could have these stories when he was alive. I want to say at least 6 years, given he went from Air Force Basic through the technical school of aircraft maintenance and then was, you know, able to do wherever he was, whoever his unit was when he was in England, and then eventually found his way to Okinawa. And then when he got there and got married, he stayed a little longer because of the marriage status. And then he just got out and came home. So I want to say like 6 years.
I got you. Cool. And do you have any siblings?
I do. I've got my brother. He's on the other side of the state here in New York. 3 years difference.
Well, it's ten
Stay in
years
touch.
between me and Shane, and 15 between Tony and I. So,
Yeah. You're actually closer to my kid because my oldest is in his 30s. My middle is in her 20s now. My God. And my youngest is just going to be turning 18. So, but you know that him and Hayden are buds.
So what led you to want to join the military, especially the Marine Corps, for the first branch?
You know, because a lot of people like the Marine Corps is like, you know, especially graduated in 87. I enlisted in 88. Like, it was generally like a peacetime military thing. There wasn't a lot of, you know, it wasn't like patriotism and all that other stuff that was really being ramped up right after 9/11. There were a lot of people who joined after 9/11 who really wanted to pitch in. I went to college for a year. I was going to Erie Community right here in our area. And I was doing okay, but it just kind of felt like, you know, I'd never really had that slay the dragon kind of experience. I hadn't been tested. Like, and I, you know, I kind of felt like something I personally needed some kind of like a benchmark or a challenge for myself to feel like, you know, I passed some kind of rite of passage. I didn't know it at the time that that's what I was looking for, but I knew I needed something that was bigger than me to belong to. And you know, just by sheer luck, or you know, no, I'll say luck. I won't be a smart ass about that one. But
You can be as smart ass as you want, brother. That's
the
all good.
I
It's all
know, like
good.
everybody digs into their military experience and stuff. But honestly, like I'd go back and do the Marine Corps again in a heartbeat if there was a time machine, in a heartbeat. But a Marine recruiter called my mom while I was at school. And of all things, my Okinawan mother, who had been on mainland Japan, suppose, you know, her story was that her and my mother, her my grandmother, had fled when they knew that the bombings were gonna, the like, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were gonna get bombed, that they had, you know, that they were hiding at that time
I
and lived through
cannot
post-World War II.
imagine. I cannot imagine.
Yeah, and you wanted to, I mean, and my mom grew up after, you know, post-World War II. Okinawa had been leveled because it had been occupied by Americans. Marines came in and whooped the Japanese out of there. And the civilians had to live through that. No social services, you know, no public utilities. You know, she literally grew up in a thatch roof hut with no electricity at one point. I'm like, I could get away with nothing. I couldn't complain about a thing as a kid. Because she would always have that story. She's like, you think you got it tough? I'm like, okay. But
I tell you, Kids these days, man, they have no idea. I mean, especially my two kids, they have no idea how good they have it, It's
Exactly. I try to say it now when, because I still substitute occasionally,
Oh, cool.
and like so Matt's friends and Matt himself and all of them. I'm just like, you know what, this is the price of, Matt especially because of the way he got to grow up. I'm like, this is the price of growing up almost too well loved. Like you've had it really good. Which all of the, so all of those resiliency, self-reliance lessons, some of those skills that you could have been getting if things were a little bit tougher. I don't want to say bad, but like, if you had to do more for yourself, you'd have some skills earlier. They'll come, but I don't want to hear any complaining because you got to learn it sometime. But I felt that when I went to enlist in the Marine Corps, because my mom got that phone call from the recruiter. And her mind, of all things, was, well, you can use it for school money, reserves, tuition, that type of thing. And then, I'm not gonna joke, my the recruiter shows up, and she's this extremely attractive Portuguese Polynesian woman who met my mom first, and because she wanted to make sure that, oh, that was the TV, because my mom wanted to, be involved. And I'm like, all right, well, at that point, I wasn't interested. I was like, no, mom, why'd you make an appointment with a recruiter? I'm a college student. I don't want to do it. I see the recruiter and I'm like, hey, she's cute. I'm not going to lie. But so that kind of opened up my mind a little bit. It made me receptive. But then she ended up befriending my mother a little bit because she was Polynesian, Hawaiian. So between the Portuguese diet and the Hawaiian diet, my mom's Asian cooking spoke to her. So my mom sat down. She complimented my mom. We sat down. We're actually having a lunch. Like my mom made my lunch from scratch. So I sat down and actually listened. And then I made an appointment. This is before the internet, so I had to make an appointment to go into the office. And they popped that VCR track into the big bulky VCR machine, like back in the 80s when you had to wheel the whole set into the classroom. So it was that. It was like on the cart with the big TV. I was like, man, that
I'm
was so long
surprised it
ago.
wasn't one of those big discs. Remember
Oh,
those
the laser.
things? The
Oh,
laser
the big
discs.
discs. Oh, those were short lived, but those were cool. I still remember those, man. But yeah, so I watched the big recruiting video, and there's like they always show the cool stuff
Which
because it
recruiting
sounded.
video was it? Do you remember? Was it the sword in the knight or in the
Oh, it was
dragon
before that.
or
It was like before
Oh, it
that.
was way before that.
That came out.
Oh yeah, duh. Obviously, it
That
was before
advertising
that.
came out. Right as I was finishing up the enlistment, that's when the sword and the silent drill team and the snap and the pop video with the sharp uniforms. No, this was like the 3 and 5 color pattern green camo and the big Kevlar, like almost SS looking design helmet that we used to wear way back when. Like it was that one. So guys running around playing cowboys and Indians, diving and rolling in the obstacle course and everything. And I was hunter, martial arts, running around in the woods, doing all that crazy stuff and everything. So, the obstacle courses, that spoke to me. I was like, oh, that's cool. So after that, and then the very first question she asks afterwards, you've got this attractive woman who clearly is wearing a Marine Corps uniform and passing everything, and she just looks you straight in the face and she goes, so do you think you can handle Marine Corps basic training? You're gonna say no. Of course I'd say yes. Like and inside, like the little 2-year-old in my gut's like, I don't know. But but of course you go ahead and pipe them, like, yeah, I can do it. I can do it.
And how
And I
old were
could.
you when you
I was
joined?
19.
19?
Yeah. So that was kind of how it started. But like I don't think anybody in my generation of the Marine Corps, there were some, but I think overall, because again, it was more of a peacetime military join. It wasn't like post 9/11, man. Guy and girls. Anybody who joined post 9/11, they knew what they wanted to do. They if they walked into that recruiting office, they knew what they were doing. So as the process went on, I was like, yeah, you know what? This is probably what I need. I need a good kick in the pants. I need a push. So that's, got down to Paris Island and questioned my life for 12 weeks and like
When did you go
whined
to
and cried.
boot camp? What time of the year did you go to boot camp?
I went from May, like May 29th, I want to say. So it was summertime. It was hot.
Yeah.
And growing up in this area and spending
Right.
most of my time in this area,
Right.
whoo, that was not fun.
Right. You weren't used to
No,
it.
not at all.
I mean,
Not at all.
I'm from Florida, so I
Right.
mean, even when I went to boot camp to Paris Island, and we went, it was still hot, and then it got cold,
Oh, so you got the worst of both.
and it got cold, you
Yeah.
know.
I think people forget that. Like they think, oh, Paris Island, South Carolina, it's hot.
Right.
And like, no, the Carolinas can get frigid. It's just that, it doesn't last as long.
Right. So what, so you went into the Marine Corps at 19. You served 4 years active duty in the Marine Corps in the beginning. And then you got out, and when did you get out
That was
of the Marine
80 to
Corps?
92. 88 to 92 was my active duty tour. I was supposed to go in. The whole enlistment process was a little wonky though, and I know this is probably more common a story than I thought it was at the time. But I was told that like I was good in English class, and they said, "Oh, you can go in for photojournalism. You can go in for public affairs." I was like, "Oh, okay." So I went through the whole shebang. I like the public affairs office at the Buffalo MEP station. I had to have an interview and do a writing sample for the lieutenant that was in charge of that.
Oh.
I actually like went through and got screened for that. So I thought this was legit. And then I get to MEPS that day to ship out, and they're like, we don't have a contract for you. And I thought they said open contract. And we know when you join the Marine Corps open contract, you're going infantry. And I was like, whoa, 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 that's not. I wasn't going to go infantry. He's like, no, you have no contract. And then I told him the whole story about public affairs, photojournalism, yada yada yada, and he's like, oh, okay. And they're like, well, you can walk away today if you want to, because the Marine Corps is technically in breach of contract, so you can walk away, and if you want to, you can start this process all over again and see if we can really kind of hook you up with the job that you want. Or The and then he pulls out like the old, you remember the green and white sheet wide sheets of paper that used to come out of the printers,
Oh
like with the wheels,
with the holes on the
yes,
edges.
and you had to tear off that strip when you pulled it off the machine. He pulled he dropped a stack of that on there, and he's like, these are the jobs that are open right now if you still want to go to basic training today. And I was like, well, crap. So I was like, you know what, if I walk away today, I am not coming back. I've gotten my headspace. I've said the things I needed to say to the people that I'm leaving. If I walk away right now, I know I'm not coming back. And it was one of those moments where even a dumb 19-year-old is like, you know what? Just push through. Just push through. So I went from, planning on being a photojournalist, and then they gave me the three. And one of them was finance, another one was, I can't even remember what the other choice was. And then another one was admin clerk. So I had those three choices, and none of them were anything super cool or sexy or high speed or anything. They were all practical, important jobs, but none of them were sexy. And then when I got out of basic training, you remember, so I go to basic training, and then I think that, like, within the last 3 weeks before you graduate, they give you your orders and like, oh, you're going to admin school. I'm like, okay. So I went to admin school, and I was an admin clerk for 4 years and stuff. But I got to go to Okinawa. I
During
met
your
my
4 year enlistment, right?
yeah, during my active duty tour, I met my family from my mom's side. So the Marine Corps paid for me to have a family reunion. I was born on Okinawa, but we left when I was like 1 year old, so I don't remember any of these people. So like the Marine Corps gave me a whole year on Okinawa to reunite with the family and meet cousins and be taken all over the island on personal tours for places that like your average American white kid isn't going to get. So that was worth it. And then I finished out at Headquarters Marine Corps and came off active duty in 92. And then I did that last 2 years with the, at the time it was India Company, 3rd Battalion, 25th, over here in Buffalo. And it was a, they listed themselves as a cold weather infantry unit. So in the temperate weather, we just did standard infantry training, and then come cold weather, we did snowshoes and skis and tents and froze and, did all that stuff.
That's cool, man. What and so how was so you transitioned from active duty Marine Corps to you were on IRR for 2 years, correct?
No, I was active
Inactive
reserve.
reserve?
No, I
Or
was active reserves. I was
you
drilling
were
with the.
active reserve, so you did that for 2 years.
Yeah, right off the bat. The
And
and
then
actually,
you.
it was probably the best piece of advice that I could have gotten from an active duty guy. He's like, enlist in the, just go active reserves right away. You can always stop because you've already got your honorable. So you can always quit the reserves if you want to, but just do it because if you go home and you don't do it, it's even harder to kind of get back into that mindset. So I went, as soon as I got back, I contacted the unit and I went to India Company 325 and, started showing up to reserve weekends pretty quick.
Nice. And so what was the transition like between going reserves to the Nat to the Army National Guard? Or what was the was there a break? Was there a lapse in between the
No.
reserves, Marines, and or and the Army National Guard, or no?
No, there wasn't. My buddy Tom, who, we'd gone through high school together, we hunted together, martial arts, everything under the sun. He was going to college at the time when I was on active duty. And when he graduated, he said, "Okay, I always wanted to be join the military. Always wanted to be a cop, so I'm going to join the 105th Military Police Unit over here on the Army Guard side." So he's like, "But if you join with me, I can get recruiting points, which will help with promotion, and we'll get to work together." I'm like, "All right, cool." So I pretty much just transitioned right. Well, like the end of 1 month was Marine Corps Reserve Unit, and then boom, the very like I think I may have had a month and a half because of when they timed their reserve weekends. So a month and a half later, I'm showing up to Connecticut Street Armory, I
Connecticut
think.
Street Armory, yep.
I think it was Connecticut Street Armory or
Yep.
Maston, one of the two. No, actually it was Maston, which is the one that's the really beautiful wood one. Is that Connecticut? I want to say that's Connecticut Street.
I think it's Connecticut. That's the one that's by the water, right?
Yes, I think
Right
that's
off
the.
of.
I haven't touched that world in so long, so I'm
Yeah.
lost. So I want to say my first drill with them would have been Maston, which was like a big warehouse near a school and everything like that. They had a really great motor pool that was blocked in. So yeah, about a month and a half from my last drill as a Marine reservist, month and a half later, boom, I'm checking in street clothes and like, "Hey, I'm supposed to be here for the Army Guard side." And then I think there were a few of us, but there were my buddy Jim O'Ra was another prior service Marine, and then there were a couple other guys. Dean Smith was another one. He's prior Army active duty. Like we all kind of clicked together in our little crew there along with Tom, and we'd showed up for the reserves for a little while, and then they sent us to sort of this hybrid military police school where for 6 months we didn't show up to the unit. We went to Amherst. And there was like a 6 month classroom instruction phase for military police training. And then once we completed and graduated that, we went down to Fort Leonard Wood. And for like 2.5 weeks, they ran us through all of the field exercise and qualifications and stuff like that. So,
That's cool.
not exactly, but roughly, it was like going through like a civilian law enforcement academy when we were here, because it was all classroom topics, knowledge of the law, UCMJ. It was the talking points and all the procedure, and then we got to put it into action. And then we did some more of the combat support role of military police. We did the hands-on portion there when we went to Fort Leonard Wood. So we got in Humvees and we drove convoys and we did exercises and we practiced all the. They didn't call it CQB at the time. It was MOUT, Military Operations in an Urban Terrain was the jargon at the time. So we did all that stuff while we were there, and then after that, we went back and started drilling with the unit once we were qualified.
And so how long were you in the Army National Guard for?
I want to say that it was for another total of six.
Okay.
Like I said before we started recording, though, like my reserve math is a little fuzzy because once I turned in all my records over to the Air Force Reserve, which is the one that I'm finishing out in, they crammed all they took all of those records and they calculated the reserve time by points. So it was 6 years, but because of the way they calculated the points, it actually was less time time
Right,
because of the points system.
when it,
But it
military
was like,
time. And now from the reserve, from the Army National Guard, you went, there was a lapse, right, between then and going into the Air Force reserves, correct?
I
Gotcha.
went, I had about an 8-year gap, where I was just straight civilian. I got my certification for teaching, and went to college, was doing that, living the civilian life and everything. And then out of the blue, an Air Force recruiter calls and says that they pulled up my records and realized that, like, if I did 6 more years, and I think their numbers were off, but that's kind of what they started with. They're like, well, you can do, if you did 6 more years, you'd be eligible for your reserve retirement. And at the time, like, I'd already, and here's where it kind of ties into the whole topic of what we're talking about here, and the whole point of these conversations is, when your average, when somebody who doesn't join the military goes straight into the workforce or goes straight into school, they're building reputation, networking,
Resume.
career knowledge, experience, education that directly translates to something in the civilian world. Now, the military can do a really good job of helping you in terms of resiliency and job skills that translate, but you miss out on the networking, you miss out on the cultural part of it. So I didn't actually start going to college for my education degree until I was like 28, which is really late for a lot of people. So I missed out on, and again, I say missed out, meaning like windows of opportunity that are normal for people versus people who join the military and then jump back into the civilian world. So, getting a teaching job a little bit later than the average person under ideal circumstances who would do their 4 years, get a teaching job, and then maybe work on their master's degree part-time, or, go straight through and do 6 years and get their master's degree and start teaching right away. I was at least 3 to 4 years behind, the average person that way. So I knew that if I only relied on an educational career path or some kind of a professional career path, and in terms of retirement, in terms of pension, in terms of like healthcare and all those things, I was already kind of basically 4 to 5 years behind everybody else who I'd been hired with because they were younger. So they had that much more time in their future to build towards that. So when the recruiter calls and says something about, my reserve retirement, I'm like, it's kind of like money in the bank. I'm not going to see it until I'm 60 because it's a reserve retirement. But that's me investing in something that is going to take longer and actually adds value to what I bring to my future self. And at the time, my marriage, this is what I can contribute. This is my way of contributing to the household. So I was like, it just kind of seems like the smart thing to do. So yeah. So
Seemed like a
again,
no-brainer, right?
I mean, it was like it. Going back into that world, even part-time, like, 'cause at that point, I had a wife, I had a kid, I had a full-time job. She had a full-time job, has a full-time job. All of those things, house, we're taking Matthew to gymnastics, and, like, there's vacations and family functions, and those all exist over here. And then you throw on the military component over here, and it's entirely separate as a reservist. So, like, switching between the two constantly is really, it's a different type of struggle. Obviously, it's in some ways being 100% active duty all the time is, it's easier on your brain, I think, in terms of like work-life balance. Because if you're married with a family and you're full-time active duty, everybody's in it. Everybody's living near the base. Everybody's doing it. It's normal. Like all the other people around you are military members. And so when you go to your kid's soccer thing, everybody's going through the same thing that you're going through, as a family. So, oh, well, John's going to go, John's got to deploy to here. Oh, he's got to go away to NCO school for another 2 months. Sally's going to get promoted, but she's got to do this, this, and this. It's normal. It's part of your everyday life. But as a reservist, there's all your civilian lifestyle things over here. And then you again have to walk away from it to go do the military thing. So all of this kind of goes on pause. And we all know legally your job can't hold it against you. They can't not promote you. They can't not do this. They can't hold up your raises, they can't fire you, all of those things. But those are still windows of time that you feel like you're neglecting something over here.
Right.
You feel like, oh geez, I should be home because I know it's 5 o'clock at night. I'm at NCO school, or I'm at, like in my case, I had to go back to security forces because my MP training in the army had been 8 years prior. So they said, we got to send you back to we got to send you back to our school. So I went to security forces school for the Air Force for 3 months.
Wow.
So, like the whole time I'm there, and thank God for the technology of the time, we could talk, we could video chat.
Right.
There were a couple times when we actually watched TV shows together at the same time and kind of simulcasted them.
That's cool.
But like, as a reservist, it's not part of your everyday lifestyle, so it feels like you're choosing one over the other, and it has its own form of a struggle. By no
Right.
means is it worse or better. It's just a different struggle.
Right. Whenever you, so was there during that break, that 6 or 8 year break, did you experience any kind of like negativity from, coworkers or like, when you went for job interviews, did you get the hairy eyeball 'cause, you served in the military or the, or because if you, they knew you're a Marine and Marines are quote unquote crazy. Did any of that, like, how was that? What was that like?
When I got off active duty the first time and with the Marine Corps, the kind of like, ooh, Marine, it was more sort of like a, oh my gosh, you were a Marine. It was like a, oh wow, type of reaction overall. When it came down to, because when I got off active duty, I jumped into school. So I was I was doing the college student thing. I had actually started running my own martial arts school on the, as part of this too. I was
I didn't
working
know that,
for
or maybe I did know that and I just forgot. But
It's
yeah.
yeah, it's like so long ago too that I very like in my mind, I don't run around going like, oh yeah, I ran martial arts school. Yeah, but it comes up on occasion. But it obviously it makes sense for this. So
But
like
you
I
have
was
a pretty extensive
doing this.
resume, brother. I mean, you've done a lot. You've done a lot.
I've Peter Panned my life. Like, this is the problem with not being able to commit to any one thing and going, oh look, sparkles, that's really cool. I'll do that for a while. Oh, I'll do this for a while. Oh, I'll do that for a while. I've had fun. I've had fun. I've done a lot of things that I enjoyed doing. But yeah, so I got more of the, oh wow, you're a Marine thing. Being on a college campus there, in the early 90s, there wasn't as much of what's going on now in terms of like, you're locked into your tribe of ideology. There wasn't as much of that. But there were still people, and we had echo we a lot of the instructors, the college professors were circa Vietnam and slightly after. That was their age range. So there was some quiet but cool respect from some of them, but you could tell that a few of them were like of the protester generation of that point in time.
The what we used to call hippies.
There were more than a few that were, they weren't down on the military openly, but they definitely were of that, oh well, the military infrastructure. Or, the military machine. They would use certain words or phrases. You'd be like, "That's not what we call it." So you kind of know. You like they'd use a couple phrases, or there'd be ways that they'd say things. You're like, "Oh, that's how you feel." But as long as I got my grades and I, nobody was openly hostile, I didn't care. I do remember I had one college professor that was insisting that because we were part of NATO, that meant that, as American troops and our NATO allies, that we could swap equipment. So we could get supplied from the French or the English or whoever. And I'm like, that's not how it works. He's like, no, absolutely. I'm like, no, we carry this equipment, this ammunition, these type of food rations, blah, 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 blah. And we can't just run over to an English unit and go, hey, give me some of your bullets. It's not how it works. That's not how it works. I mean, we coordinate, but like, it's not like we're uniform. We're not uniform with the Brits or the French or the Italians or anybody else.
And then, all right, so,
There were some college professors
excuse
that
me.
were like that. I got a little bit more of
Excuse
that
me.
sort of negative-ish a little bit after I got back from Bosnia with the Army Guard.
I gotcha. How was what was Bosnia like, if you don't mind, if you want to
No,
share?
I don't mind. Honestly, like relative, and I'll start off by saying, like, relative to what a lot of guys who've gone to Afghanistan and done a lot of the recent Mid East joy that we've experienced, it was not that bad. But constantly being in a state of readiness under any circumstances can take its toll. But we were there primarily for peacekeeping. So Bosnia was like almost forever ago in a lot of people's mind. But essentially, it was an internal civil war between different factions. Similar in some ways to what happened in Rwanda. In that way, you had different tribes basically that were killing each other off. And the Serbs were doing a lot of heinous things to their own people. And NATO and the US, as its own operating entity, we like honestly, I can't remember how they broke down the mission, because some of the troops that we rubbed elbows with were part of the NATO operation, and then there were those of us that were sort of like keeping the stability infrastructure of the military presence alive and well. And that's what our unit was part of. So we were doing peacekeeping operations, and we were supporting the peacekeeping operations. So we would do convoy escorts for 1 month. So 1 month of our tour, once we got there and got trained up and everything was going on, we would be on, almost like a fire department. Like they'd be like, hey, they got a convoy that's going to transport, a medical unit from here to here. They need a convoy escort. So that's us. So we would, I was a squad leader, and there were three Humvees that were up armored with, guns. So we looked like angry porcupines with all the muzzles sticking out.
And that's a lot different now. I mean,
Very.
armor then compared to now is a lot different.
Yeah. Ours was 100% passive, very heavy. Thank God, the worst case I ever had incident that I knew about, it wasn't even my squad, was a guy who mistakenly left his hand inside the door frame as he opened up that fully armored door. Yeah, your face says you know exactly where it's going. And Bosnia gets weather like we do. Like I would call home and
Wet
stuff like
and
that.
nasty and
And
cold
so,
and
like, imagine this time of year here. I'd call and be like, hey, what's the weather like there? Like, oh, we're getting a blizzard. 3 days later, we would be getting a blizzard in Bosnia. So the weather was exactly the same. So guy's got his hand in the frame, wind gusts up, middle of a snowstorm, bam, right on there. And I mean, these doors were heavy. So I mean, and that's the way it was. So we would escort medical. We used to escort payroll. We escorted the army band that was going around and doing a morale tour.
That's cool.
We
And how
reinforced.
long were you in Bosnia for?
We were in country. I want to say that I could be wrong in the numbers. I want to say we were in country for 7 months. The activation orders were for 9, or we were in country for 9 months, and the activation orders were for a total of 12 for all the processing and everything that happened. One of the two. One of the two. Honestly, like, you show up, you do your job, and then you leave. That was kind of my mindset at the time. So for that 1 month that we were on convoy escorts, that's what we did. And then the other month that, when we were off of the convoys, we were doing base law enforcement, and we were doing security, and at the time what they called the TOC. So like we would have to be internal physical security for the operation center. And
Okay,
then
I
we would have
gotcha.
a law enforcement patrol that would walk the base 24/7.
And so that was your MOS was an MP basically, which is military
Army.
police. And okay, so Bosnia was okay in a sense that, it was peacekeeping missions and all that jazz.
It was stressful in its own way, but I can honestly say that I'm very glad that we never had a single shot fired at us in anger. They weren't trying to get at us. They were trying to get at each other. So nobody really messed with us. We had like one time when we were doing a convoy. And it's actually kind of a funny story, even though it's not, because it's a sign of how horrible it was there. Things were stable. Nothing was really going on in the sector that we were assigned. Other countries had other parts of Bosnia, and I guess it was a little bit more hot in some areas. But We're driving an escort, and I guess this guy comes staggering drunk out of a local establishment. We were not allowed to go out in town when we were not working. We were locked onto the base.
Right, you couldn't do anything.
No. And it was a dry base, which was probably a really smart move. So this guy comes staggering out of the bar and he starts pounding on the hood of my Humvee. And we had translators with us, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? We're locked into an armored up Humvee. This thing can take bullets and explosions, and like, I'm not worried about a guy punching the hood. But I'm like, what the heck's going on? And like, my turret gunner up top is looking around and like, okay, is this starting something? No, okay. 'Cause it was really very stable. I gotta say, it was fairly stable. And the translator's like, yeah, he's a Serb. He's saying stuff like, we're made out of iron, we're bulletproof, you're soft, blah, 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 blah. And so he's just drunk and knocked out.
Pissing. He
He's
was
just
trying to get
about
in a
knocked out.
pissing contest with y'all.
Yeah. So, and we were stuck there. I can't remember why we were stopped, but we were stopped and we had like 4 more minutes that we had to wait for at least. And I think it was because of our escort. Somebody was doing something in town.
I gotcha.
So we're there. So like I made it very clear that we were not going to threaten this guy, but like I tapped the leg of my M60 gunner. I tapped his leg, and he and then the old turrets. I don't know how they are now, but the old turrets, you had like a pin that you pulled out, and then they had the little rivet holes around the ring. So you manually swing it around. So he pulls the pin out, and you can hear that metal scrape
Click,
go.
click, 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 click,
It goes,
click.
and then all of a sudden he just swings it around, and now the muzzle's still like this. You never pointed the gun at him, but he just swung the muzzle around so it was in line with him, and then he locked it back in. Guy walked away. I was like, all right, that's all we need. I mean, honestly, that's, it's kind of a funny story because nothing ever came of it. But, I think the saddest thing that I always felt really horrible about was the time that we were on a convoy and we ran over a little girl's puppy. It ran out into the street.
Oh
And she
no.
saw it. Oh, I felt
Oh
terrible.
man.
I felt really bad because I'm like, could you imagine being back home and that's your dog? And
Oh.
everything that these people have been through, and here this poor girl and her
Yeah.
family, and we run over her damn puppy. And it's a convoy, it's a military mission. We could not stop for a puppy. So I know that did a really great job for local support. I was like, oh, that's crap. And my
How
gunner,
old were you then? It, again, if you don't mind me
late
asking.
20s. Yeah, no.
Late
Well,
20s.
I was late 20s, late 20s.
I got you.
So like a little bit older. I'd been on active duty before. My driver, unfortunately, was like maybe a 20-year-old kid. He just went white right away. He went white right away. I was like, oh man, I knew he felt it.
Well, I mean, in those things, man, you're driving and you can't really.
You don't stop.
I mean, you don't stop. You can't really see. It's kind of hard to determine whether or not it. I mean, that you he probably thought that was the girl.
Yeah, because
That probably flashed through his head
dead
initially.
seriously, I didn't think about that before, but you're dead right because she like I remember it. I can picture it in my head because I felt so bad. Little white puppy comes right down the road, and you heard it. You knew what was going on, but she did take 2, 3 running steps towards us, and I'm like, oh my! And she thankfully stopped. So here's my young driver, and right on, like somewhere in his head, he's going, oh my God, she's gonna run in front of my truck.
Did I just kill that person? Did I just run
Yeah.
over that girl? Yeah,
That's scary. I didn't even think about
I
that.
can
I was
only
just like,
imagine, dude. I can only imagine.
yeah. I mean, I didn't even think about that until you brought it up. But like, he's somewhere in his reactions, he's like, oh my God, she's gonna run out in front of me. So, if he's, yeah, and he's got to pay attention to the vehicle in front of him, and we know we got vehicles behind us, we cannot stop.
Because there's you have to maintain so much distance between each vehicle. So, and then so that you did that, now you're in the Air Force Reserves, correct?
Yes.
And then when did you start that career path?
2017, 2016.
And
Like again.
you went to Iraq, right?
Kuwait. We went to
Kuwait.
Kuwait. Yeah. So we went
The
there
Green
to.
Zone, right?
Yeah, it's it, we were there doing physical security for Ali Asaleem. So that's sort of like I call it the Chicago O'Hare of it's a hub. It's a hub base where everything comes in and out of. So we were physical security there. Pretty much the same thing that that would happen at Niagara Falls or any other base here in the States. We did physical security. We did entry control points, patrols. We controlled access to and from the flight line for security purposes and everything. But since Kuwait was a host nation and a friendly, it was a pretty low stress. Internally, it was a pretty low stress environment, because it's a host nation. It's not like we're not, it's not like being in Iraq where we've won and we've occupied and now we're stabilizing. It was
It's
Kuwait.
kind of like, and I don't mean to like discredit, this is not like a hack on going to Qatar or anything, like that's not what I'm trying to say, but it's kind of like a vacation, kind of sorta.
It was very low key in the
In a
beginning. And I, you know, there's no disrespect in that at all. 'Cause when, you know, being there, I was looking at it, and before I went, 'cause this was my very first time deploying or going anywhere with the Air Force, I was gearing my brain up for a Marine Corps or Army deployment.
Yeah.
Like that was where my head was going.
Right.
And so like, I'm ramping my brain up and I'm like, all right, you know, we got to be ready for this. We got to be ready for that. You know, turn this part of your brain back on. It's been off for a little while.
Right.
Like I was fit as hell. Yada yada yada, and
Oh,
then we
you're
get
still fit, brother. You're still fit as a fiddle.
there.
Come
This is
on,
how
man.
old men
Just
don't die.
give yourself some credit, brother. How you're yeah, and let's how old are you right
I'm
now?
55. I'm
You're
55.
55. And you have a six pack, so you're good. You're good. You're good,
But
brother.
anyways, but yeah, so like I had that mindset before we went, and then we get there, and there's like they got a game room
Right.
and there's like
Right. The
it,
Air
all
Force, man, is the way to
oh
go, bro.
they you know living
My
was
oldest
good.
brother, Tony, served in the Air Force, and he was like, when he found out I was going to the Marine Corps, he was like, bro. You picked the wrong branch.
Yeah.
And then we went to, obviously, like Marine Corps is a lot different,
Oh yeah.
when it comes to like amenities, I'll say. When we deployed to Afghanistan in 2009, we had to stop over in Kyrgyzstan, which at the time was the. Dude, I lost my train of thought. Customs. So
Oh.
you'd go to Kyrgyzstan. You'd be there for, I think we were there for like a week, maybe 2 weeks to process, our gear and all that stuff, and then we went to Afghanistan. And let me tell you, that it was Air Force base, and that frickin' chow hall was off the chain. I
That's cool.
mean, I had never been in a chow hall that you could get self-serve ice cream.
Yeah. Welcome to the Marine.
Or candy bars. I mean, you could walk into the chow hall on that base and take candy bars. Full-size candy bars, Snickers, Kit Kats. I mean, they had a whole smorgasbord when it came to that type of
Yeah, and
stuff.
there was nobody telling you one per
And there
person
was
per couple.
nobody telling you that you could take as much or as little as you wanted. I was like, what? And that was towards the end of my Marine Corps, because I got out in 2011. So, I was flabbergasted, dude, blown away. I was like, what the fuck did I do?
Oh yeah. Well,
Why did I join the Marine Corps?
even when I was in, like when I was in the Marine Corps and I was at Camp Kinzer, during my active duty time, I was on Okinawa, and like I said, I got to reunite with family, but I was stationed at Kinzer, which they said the hotel by the sea, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I go all the way up to Hanson and Schwab, and I'm like, oh, now I understand. So Kinzer was still nice-ish because it was a logistician's base. You know, like they were, you know, we were getting shipments in and out and they had to be processed. And like, you know, you had people that were rigging stuff and flying stuff and trucking stuff. So it was a pretty nice base compared to like Hanson and Schwab, which were at the northern training areas. But we were still sneaking over to Kadena Air Base. We'd come up with excuses to have to go to Kadena Air Base just to go ahead and hit the chow hall. Oh, same thing. And I mean, we're talking like an established. That's not even a deployed area. That's just like, oh, there's a Marine Corps base, very normal base. And even compared to that, or comparing that to Kadena Air Base, like, let's go to the Chow Hall. Oh, that was heaven.
And so now you're in the process of retiring, correct?
That was the original plan.
Oh man.
So yeah, so this kind of ties into a couple of the questions that you got in the pipeline here. The original plan was to I had my and just today, yesterday actually, we confirmed that my request to withdraw my retirement application had been approved. What ended up happening was, and this again, these are stresses upon stresses that people are putting on themselves. In some ways, if you don't actively realize that, whether it's true or not, as a reservist, more so I think than active duty, but even on active duty, I imagine you run into these same problems. But as a reservist, you're dealing with people, in my opinion, purely my opinion. And I think generally speaking, everybody wants to do a good job, but you're dealing with a group of people who are operating skill-wise, probably at least one to possibly two rank skill levels below what their active duty component was or is. So not everything gets done the way it's supposed to be done. And I'll explain how that ties into why I'm not retiring in a second.
Was there a mix-up? Was there a mess-up with the paperwork or something, or?
No, everything's fine. I can retire if I want to. But at no point, and again, part of it falls on me because you and I were raised in the Marine Corps. So, like, if there's a big change and it's going to affect you, somebody in your chain of command, at least in my active duty experience, somebody in your chain of command is going to make sure that they grab you by the neck and go, "Hey, pay attention to this. Does this apply to you?" Nobody actively, passionately led me as an NCO about this information. But so I can transfer my post 9/11 GI Bill over to my dependents, and I want to do that for my youngest, who's getting ready to go to college soon. What changed in like 2013, I think it's on the website when you go there and try to do the transfer. What changed at about 2013, so like almost 10 years ago, they said, you can use it whenever you want, but if you want to transfer your post 9/11 GI Bill to somebody else, you have to be retainable for 4 years in front of you. You have to have 4 years on your contract in front of you. So this is something that I should have done
4 years ago.
plus years ago. So at the point where I was enlisting, they may have mentioned it, but it's lost in all of that administrative stew of 90,000 other things you got to do. Never really got foot stomped. Pre-deployment, nobody foot stomped this thing and said, "Hey, do this now, because if you don't do it now and you've only got this much time on your contract, make sure you do it now." Nobody said anything. And that was very clearly stated by me to my recruiter as to why one of the major reasons why I was joining, why I was going to go ahead and finish this out. Obviously, retirement was a big deal, but also having benefits that I could transfer to my kids was another thing. Nobody foot stomped it. So there's really nothing that can be done at this point. So I am in the process of reenlisting in the Air Guard. It's the 107th Air National Guard over on the other side of the base there.
Out of Niagara Falls, right? So for the listening audience, we both live in Buffalo, New York. So we live about 30 minutes from Niagara Falls. Just so you're all aware.
Exactly. Opposite side of the state from New York City and the ocean.
Like 6 hours from the city.
So I'm in the process of doing that. What I'll have to do is game it so that I enlist for 5, so that I definitely have those 4 years covered, because by the time all the paperwork and everything gets done, if I just do 4 years and then I end up, by the time I get the transfer in, I'm under 4 years, I'm still screwed. So I'm just going to go ahead and enlist for another 5. I'm leaving security forces as a career field. I'll switch over to another, I said, "Hey, what's the shortest MOS school? What's the shortest tech school that you have?" And they're like, "Well, it's either admin or personnel, one of the two, whatever we find is available." I'm like, "Good, send me that." So I'll retrain into a different career field, and knock out another 5 years as a weekend warrior again. Stay the active the AGR order side, I'm done with that. I'm ready to just have like a 9 to 5 Monday through Friday schedule again. So I'll knock that out. I actually this really kind of pissed me off a lot, because I'm like, where in my leadership, where in Air Force, big Air Force, where in the communication process was this articulated clearly enough? Because obviously I dropped the ball, because I didn't go, "Hey, gee whiz, I want to do this." But like, if you do this for you, When do you start thinking about looking at your GI Bill? When you're
Right.
enrolled in college.
Right.
And so
Right.
logically,
Well,
systematically, that's the same time I'm
and
going to start looking at it when I'm doing it for my kid who's going to school.
right. Right.
So 4 years ago,
Not
I'm
four
going to go, hey,
years
you know,
prior, right.
exactly. Matt's not even a freshman in high school right now. Let me start thinking about transferring my GI Bill to him for 4 years in the future. That's not reasonable. That's not average. So that's just the game the way it is.
So whenever you transfer it, so will he be able to use it because he's going to college
Yeah.
next year
Yeah. Yeah. He's
or
graduated. He's a senior. So
fall
he.
of or spring of summer. He won't go to college this year. He'll go or will he? He'll go in the
2025,
fall.
fall 2025. Yeah, so he'll be
Right.
graduating
So
2025 in June, so he'll be starting, as long as everything lines up the way it's supposed to and there's no hitches, 2025 in the fall, he'll start his college semester.
He'll be able to actively use your GI benefits,
Yes. Yeah.
your GI Bill, correct?
Yep. As soon as the transfer is approved,
You
he
better
can start
make
using
him
that.
aware. You better make him aware. Look here.
Oh, he knows. He knows.
Look here, boy.
He's a, yeah.
You
Remember,
better not fuck this up.
well, that's those conversations that my mom used to be able to pull on me. I'm like, oh, I couldn't go to Dairy Queen with my friends. Oh yeah, I lived in a thatch roof hut for how many?
I lived in a grass hut.
This
Shut
is
up.
my version of it. I'm like,
Right,
he's like, oh,
right.
college life. I'm like, you have homework because I had to enlist for 5 more years.
Yeah.
You better be a brain surgeon, dude.
I mean, I gotta
No,
tell you, brother, I give
he's a good
you.
kid. I bust on him, but he's a good kid.
He is a good kid. Matthew is a very good kid. You and Michelle did an excellent job with him. So, kudos to the both of you. He's a good kid. He always calls me Mr. Cole, and I'm like, look, dude, you're old enough now. You can just call me Cole or fucker, whatever. Whatever. You don't have to call me Mr. Cole. And he's like, okay, Mr. Cole. And I'm like, stop calling me Mr.
I'll
Cole.
come to you. How old were the boys when they were playing baseball together and they met you as
Oh,
the coach and he
dude.
met you as the coach? I mean,
I think so. That was T-ball. So what's that like? Five, six,
yeah, I think it was like kindergarten first,
ish.
kindergarten-ish.
Yeah,
Yeah, so like you're
we've
always
known you
you're
guys
always
for
he's never
we've
going to be able to let that go.
yeah. No, it's all good. It's all.
You're
I
going to be
know
at
it's
his
all love and
wedding and he's going to call you Mr. Cole, man.
I know it's all love and it's all out of respect and all that. So obviously, I would never. You know,
Yeah.
I would never like backhand him or anything like that. Like, stop it, you know. But yeah, he's a good kid, man. Y'all did good. So that's cool that you're gonna be able to do that for him, you know, as and he won't have to worry about anything. 'Cause that covers everything, right?
Yeah. And you know, I haven't I remember the you know, I pulled up the little PDF, which is the equivalent of the brochure. Like the way the post 9/11 GI Bill operates is different than the old Montgomery. The old Montgomery used to be a flat cash amount dropped into an account. Now it's divvied
They
up so
paid
they get a little bit.
you Sergeant's BAH. I
Yeah.
think that's what they used to do. I don't know what it is like now
I
because
it's yeah, E5. It's E5 BAH and BAS equivalent. He also gets he's also gonna it's gonna be a big deal because he's going in for construction sciences, construction trade. So getting his gear for his electrician program is gonna be pricey. So that books and that books tuition or stipend or whatever they have for that is gonna be a big help for him. But but this is what we do for our kids. You know, just this is what we do.
Is he gonna be
And
Dorman?
yeah, he's going to be about an hour and a half away, so he's going to be doing the dorm thing, which is again the post 9/11 GI Bill is going to help with that.
Right.
We're in
And
New York,
where's he
so
going? What
it's going to
college is
be
he going to?
he's going to Alfred,
Alfred. Okay,
yeah,
cool. Yeah,
which is
yeah.
right in Alfred, New York.
Right.
So he's far enough away where the dorming thing is going to be a thing. But I don't know how it's going to work in terms of because I'm 99% sure that he's eligible for the Excelsior scholarship for New York State residents. So that would normally be covering his tuition. But if we drop the 9/11 GI Bill on it, I don't know if that overrides it or if he can use them concurrently. I don't know how all of that math works out, but no matter what, between the GI Bill, the Excelsior, and a couple other scholarships and things that are, that are going to be coming down the pipe, hopefully, he'll be well covered for this program.
Yeah, good. That's outstanding, man. That's outstanding. All right, brother. Well, it's been about an hour. Well, it's been an hour. So any closing ideas or remarks that you would like to talk about or anything?
Well, kudos to you right off the bat for pulling this off. I mean, starting something new. I mean, you're coming from like you're going from like not even being training wheel equivalent with some of this technology to like just diving in and doing it, which is awesome. Just the only reason to know it is because you need it. So you're putting yourself in a position where you need to know these things. So good for you for starting something brand new. Like I really love the idea that because I've known you for so long and I love you to death, man.
Thanks, brother.
Not no sarcasm at all. Dude, you're like a brother to me, dead serious. Like so the idea of finding a purpose that makes you feel like you're doing something good for the world. Hold on to that, man. That is awesome. And I you we said it in text too. Like, and no disrespect to full-on combat vets, infantrymen, spec ops guys and stuff like that, but I worry that the popularity of and full respect to them, I think they're awesome. Guys like Sean Ryan, these guys that have this unbelievable, but like less than 1% of the total military career experience of being at that elite level and telling those stories and living those experiences, that's awesome to see because in order to pull that off, you have to like exemplify everything awesome about the military and individuals who excel have to do. But that's not everybody's story, and that's not the majority of the stories. You and I are the majority of the stories. Like guys that have got a mixed bag of like a couple tours, you weren't the tip of the spear, but you still had to deal with all of the struggles and stuff like that. In my case, the mix of reserve and active duty time and like all of the struggles that go with that. Creating a voice for the everyday veteran. I think that's a really important thing right now because the popular bloggers out there that are talking about military experience, they get a lot of street credit for being spec ops guys, and they've earned it. I have no disrespect for that at all. But at the same time, I think it can make some people feel like, oh, well, I'm not as cool as, or my problems or my struggles aren't the same as, or they kind of start putting themselves on this measuring stick of bullshit in my mind. But like, if you went away from home and you were away for 3 months and you missed birthdays and you were living in a tent with a noisy ass air conditioner and you had to walk out of your cot to go take a shower in a trailer or maybe even less. And if you lived that lifestyle in any capacity and and your ears are shot because you had to qualify with your weapons and then you lived around giant generators because everything was temporary for 6, 8, 12 months at a time, and you did that many, many, many times. Respect. Shit went down. You deserve, there is nothing wrong with you saying, hey, you know what? I'm carrying some baggage. Things happened to me. And the idea that that's your message, I fully love that to death. Really, really do. Really, really love that because, like I said, like I started out with this whole thing is like, there are a lot of guys and girls, there's a lot of female service members and everything too that are going through exactly the same thing. And in some ways, it's harder for them because they're a smaller percentage and it's harder for the general public to recognize female veterans and what they struggle with, which is just as much, in some cases worse, than male veterans.
100%.
Like that struggle is real for all of us. So even if it's just swapping war stories like this, but in the end, I would say, and I'm a latecomer to this, and you're gonna laugh, go to the VA. You've been on me for years. Oh my God, you've been on me for years.
I really, I, you know what? I'm really glad that you brought that up. I, you know, for
But I would
every,
say
for,
go to the VA. Even if you don't think you got anything going on, just get in the system. I should have listened to you
yep.
how many years ago when you were telling me that?
at least 6 years ago, at least. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad you bring that
Political.
up. I'm glad you bring that up to the, to the listening audience, to all you veterans out there that think you don't deserve, anything
Or don't trust the fact that it's going to
or
do anything or they're going to do anything. Just do it.
right, just do it. I mean, the worst that they're gonna tell you is no, and if they tell you no, guess what? You might have to fight. I mean, it took me, not to go off topic or anything like that, but not to draw this out any longer, but it took me 7 years to get a diagnosis of what I have, PTSD and all that stuff. So it's not, and I know the system, the overall system, I think, is getting better. I believe it's getting better.
So trust your observation.
But I think you have to be able to you have to be able to advocate for yourself. You know what I
Yes.
mean? Like that's the big key, is being able to speak up. Even though you feel like you shouldn't have to, you owe it to yourself. If you serve this country honorably and got out and feel like you don't have, there's nothing wrong with you, or you never got hurt, or anything like that, you owe it to yourself to at least, apply for benefits or get. I can't tell you how many veterans I talk to that don't even know, aren't even registered with the VA, have never gotten medical care through the VA for a whole, wide array of reasons. They don't trust the VA. They don't, and that's a big thing, and that's primarily like the Vietnam era. Even our generation, like IRAT, OEF, OIF, that generation, it's kind of borderline with I don't trust, because I was like that when I got out of the Marine Corps. I didn't want shit to do with.
We inherited that mindset from the Vietnam era and generation just after that were our leaders, our NCOs, our officers. We inherited that. So that's cultural distrust. It's not as bad. It's definitely not as
There
bad, but bad.
are good people that work at the VA. I worked with quite a few of them, through the homeless program and all that jazz. And I will, I mean, I just can't say, I can't speak high enough of the VA homeless program and everything that they do for the homeless veterans in this community. I mean, they're out there like trying to track these dudes and these ladies down to, try and get them housed and really doing everything they within their power to help. You owe it to yourself to at least get the information.
Right?
And if that's all you want to do is get the information and it's not for you, then hey, so be it. You did more than 99.9% of the veteran population has done to this point. But yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. I'm super stoked and that you mentioned that. And
Quick sidebar. It's never too late because at the point where my dad, again, Air Force veteran, Vietnam era, probably one contract, like maybe 6 years. My mom had passed away. He was moving out of the house, and we were trying to pull every string we could. We were pulling on every string we could for resources, and had to take him through the process of processing him into the VA. Never did it. Vietnam era. I mean, and so many like, and I'm not upset with my dad. My dad raised us well. He did everything that he could to try and, keep us stable and fed and housed and raised right. But there were so many benefits that he would have had
So
it if
many benefits. So many benefits.
he had done the VA thing earlier. But again, that Vietnam generation of, nah, I'm done with my military service. I don't trust them. They screw everybody over anyways. I didn't lose a leg. I didn't go to combat. That was his mindset as a support crew guy. Like he was Air Force. He was a crew chief. He didn't get shot at. So why should he go to the VA? He doesn't have anything wrong. Well, maybe he did and didn't, but he didn't look into it. So there were so many things that could have helped us as a family. So you don't just owe it to yourself. You owe it to your dependents, your family that you're taking care of, that if it's there to help, not just you earned that to give to your family, like my situation. But my dad at retirement age But we found out that there was a, I can't even remember how much it was, but basically it was enough money to cover that Goldilocks zone where for him to go to assisted living and not have to pay for it directly. The VA benefits that we discovered he was eligible for covered his assisted living costs because that generally comes out of pocket and you don't actually start getting any kind of assistance outside of that until you go to nursing care. So other if it hadn't been for that, I don't really know how we would have been able to pay for his assisted living window.
Do you remember it was aid in attendance, right?
Yes, that was, yes, it was called aid in attendance. Bam, exactly. But and to your point, advocating for yourself doesn't mean doing it yourself. I had no idea. You introduced me to Rob Stutz and these guys. All I heard was VA rep. Didn't realize that it was New York State Veterans Representative who was helping me submit to the Federal Veterans Administration. So every state in the union is going to have some kind of veteran support that can advocate for you. And it's really good that the guys, this Conrad guy and Rob, amazing guys, amazing guys. So if they represent what happens at the state level for VA support, go to them. You don't have to do it on your own.
Yeah, the help is out there, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm, we're, proof that there are good people in this world. There are good people that work at the VA, and there are people that want to help you and want to see you succeed. So, I think.
You made a good point about, aside from the feeling is the distrust, please remember that this is a big government agency. You've been in the military. If you're looking for VA benefits, don't expect it to be easy. Expect red tape, expect a lot of forms. Be prepared in your head that they're not just going to cradle you in their arms and kiss you on the forehead and give you everything. You're going to have to do some work. It's a big government agency. There's annoying red tapes in the process. Wrap your head around that right away, and the frustrations will make sense.
And it's not going to happen overnight either.
No,
It's
agreed.
gonna it's a process and it takes time. I wish for a lack of a better term, I wish that, or a better phrase, I wish that it didn't take as long in certain cases, but I think that there is obviously, an SOP. There's a standard operating procedure for the way they process claims and all that stuff, and unfortunately, it is done by. And not unfortunately, but it's done by human beings. You know what I mean? And it takes human beings time to, go through your medical record and all that stuff, and do all the stuff that you have to go do. But I think maybe what I'd maybe on a later episode, maybe I can get one of those guys on, Rob or Conrad or even Chad, who helped me with my service claim. Yeah, there's good people out there. Y'all just keep doing what you're doing. Keep getting up, keep showing up. And we'll catch you on the flip side. This is Mojo with Kojo. Paul, thank you for being on the inaugural episode of Mojo with Kojo. I appreciate you and thank you for everything that you do, and more importantly, thank you for being my friend.
Always, brother.